From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Haunted St. Giles. Hospitals like Gale's are sometimes haunted. Bethesda is haunted by the ghost of a girl, Rebecca, in a hospital near Buckingham Palace Road, London, by an eerie black mist, which is seen in one of the wards before death. But no hospital has been so badly haunted as a hospital near Edinburgh, which we must call St. Giles. My old schoolfellow Bruce Carnegie met with an accident some years ago in Edinburgh, which necessitated his going to St. Giles. He was put in Ward D and had a cubicle to himself. The third night he was lying in bed in a state of semi-wakefulness when two nurses entered the room with a movable couch. The older of the nurses gave him an injection. They then put him on the couch and took him to a room where there were two doctors in white hoods and white robes, their faces muffled. One of them bent over him. Carnegie sensed that it was a man with a dark beard and dark gleaming eyes full of fiendish hatred. The man was intent of doing something to him. "Why don't you begin?" he found himself asking. "It's all over," a voice then said, and Carnegie was conscious of the most excruciating pain. He asked for something to relieve it, and the nurse gave him a pill. He asked for another, but she shook her head. "I cannot give you more." "Oh, hell, I can't bear it," he pleaded. "You must," she said. "Be patient." Her voice weakened and faded away. His brain cleared. He recognized his surroundings, the cubicle. He was still in it. The pain had ceased, but he retained a vivid, none too pleasant recollection of it. He later spoke about the incident to one of the nurses, and she asked, "Was this in Ward D?" "Yes," Carnegie told her. "I thought it was," she said. He asked her why, but she would not tell him, and he did not find out until he had left St. Giles. He then heard that Ward D in the hospital was well known to be haunted. He discovered that about 12 years before he went to St. Giles, there were two doctors, Mackey and McGowan, in anesthesis. Both men were in love with Hilda Reed, a very pretty petite blonde. They had been friends, but rivalry made them foes. When Mackey was knocked down by a car and seriously injured, he was put in Ward D at St. Giles, and an important operation was found to be necessary. A surgeon in the hospital named Warren undertook it. McGowan administered the anesthetic. He overdid it purposefully and deliberately, murdered Mackey. The perfect crime. He then married Hilda Reed and left St. Giles with her. It was after McGowan's death, he met with a fatal accident several days after his marriage, that all came out, and that Ward D, which Maggie had occupied, began to be haunted. The Phantom Rider. Queer and inexplicable things occasionally happen in the hunting field. They happened on the famous Dingboro hunt. My friend Harry Martin, when he was living in Blankshire, joined the Dingboro. Harry, who was not quite 30, held a commission in the Yeomanry. He, though a good rider, was inclined to be a little too risky at times. It was when he was with the hounds one day in February that a strange thing happened. The pack met at Gilsby. It was fine when they started, but after they had to run a fox down, it became foggy, and he decided not to go on. One by one, all the members of the hunt rode off, and Martin found himself alone. In clear weather, he would not have minded, but in a fog, and in a locality he did not know too well, he anticipated difficulty in getting home. A distance of 12 miles or so. He was riding along disconsolately, but tried to be cheerful, when he saw a little way ahead of him, riding in the same direction, a misty figure on a black or dark horse. He followed the rider, glad to have a companion in distress. By degrees, the fog cleared, until he was able to see the rider very distinctly. It was a woman, a brunette, but to his surprise she was dressed in the picturesque costume of ages past. Wondering who on earth she could be in such an outlandish clothes, he called to her, but there was no reply. Looking around him, he could not see any familiar objects, and he realized with no little annoyance that he had lost his way. On and on rode the woman ahead. He shouted, and she must have heard him, but she still made no response, never once turning her head. An eerie feeling came over him. She did not seem real, and the stillness and sense of isolation was so acute. It was growing dusk. The woman quickened her speed, and Martin did the same, but without getting any nearer to her. Always they were the same distance apart. Ahead of him, the ground sloped, and the speed of both riders increased. Martin tried to rein his horse in, but could not. It was as if the other horse magnetized it. They were tearing now, the wind whirring in his ears, when ahead of them he saw, to his horror, a gaping pit. The woman rode straight for it. On reaching it, she looked round, and for the first time he saw her face, white and lovely. She smiled at him, waved, and, signaling him to follow, leaped on horseback into the yawning chasm. With a frantic effort, he tore himself free of the saddle and crashed to the ground as his horse, never pausing, plunged madly forward over the brink into the depths below. Dazed, Martin picked himself up. A few more feet and he would have been over the edge. He peered down but could see nothing, only blackness. He hurried away, and after some hours finally got to his destination, more dead than alive. His story awoke interest, and he learned an explanation of what he had experienced. The locality of the pit was traditionally reputed to be haunted. In the 17th century, living in the vicinity of the Dingborough Hunt, were the Leeches, a new rich family. They had only very recently come to that part of the country. They had one child, Emily, a dark-haired beauty, and among her many admirers was Robert Hunt, the only son of a widow. Robert, an unsophisticated youth of 20, first saw Emily at a meet of the Dingborough and fell violently in love with her. She encouraged his affections. His country manners and rawness amused her, but he was just her plaything, someone with whom to pass the idle moments till Lord Hartley, the man she wished to marry, returned from abroad. When he did, she gave the cold shoulder to Robert and laughed in his face when he stammered that he loved her. Bitterly grieved, Robert threw himself into the pit and was fatally injured. Before he died, he cursed Emily and declared that she would haunt the locality of the pit till doomsday. It was her ghost that Harry Martin must have seen, an apparition as beautiful as she was evil. My Knight in Old Whittlebury Forest. When about to begin one of my nocturnal investigations, I am not infrequently asked if I'm feeling psychic. If I feel that I may see or hear something supernatural or sense something hypernormal in the atmosphere of the place. Well, on the Thursday night of my arrival at Black House, some 30 miles from Northampton, I neither felt or sensed anything untoward. The weather conditions, however, struck me as being distinctly favorable for a psychic manifestation of some kind. In my experience in a variety of climates, I have found that on nights when the weather is disturbed, as for example when there is a thunderstorm, or it is very windy and raining hard, or at the other extreme when it is exceptionally fine and still, and the moon is full, that ghostly phenomena are most likely to occur. Also, I believe ghostly manifestations are largely dependent on the time of year, the late summer and early autumn being rather more conducive to them than any other period. Hence the conditions on that September night at Black House, when a strong wind moaned and whistled through the treetops and set all the windows and doors jarring, were certainly in favor of my visit. I have been told that the phantom of a man had been seen in various parts of the house, sometimes smoking a phantom pipe when the smell of tobacco was distinctly noticeable, but beyond that I heard little or nothing. Consequently, no stories about the place were running in my mind, and I could rule out all possibilities of suggestion. Soon after my arrival at the house, while my two hostesses stood talking with my companions from the local newspaper, I got my first impressions. I suddenly sensed very strongly the presence of oak trees and stags. I mentioned this and learned for the first time that the house stood on ground that had once been formed part of Old Whittlebury Forest, which had abounded in oak trees and harbored many stags. As the night was well advanced, we began our sitting. None of us being Orthodox spiritualists, we did not form a circle but individually found the first convenient seat. We sat in darkness and in silence. The outdoor conditions kept favorable. Every now and then gust of wind howled like a host of lost souls round and round the house. Suddenly, I was conscious of a curious change in the atmosphere of the room. A new element seemed to have entered it and intermingled with it, one that was very eerie. I was trying to diagnose this change when I felt a strong psychic current sweep past me in the direction of the door leading into the garden, close to which one of our hostesses, Miss H., was sitting. The change in the atmosphere at once became clearer. There was with us some elemental presence, something of the semi-human, semi-animal species that is associated with trees and forests. At my request, one of our party had brought a dog with him, as dogs, in my opinion, are sure psychic barometers, invariably making some kind of demonstration when anything supernatural is at hand. My companion's dog now started to bark aggressively, as if there was something near at hand that it is very strongly resented. Through the window overlooking the front garden facing me, I saw a leadenish blue light, or rather glow. It lasted a few seconds, then gradually faded away. Other members of the party also saw luminary phenomena, but through a glass door that led to another part of the house. Some of these lights were in the form of a crescent, and others a triangle. During the whole time that this phenomena were manifesting, intense excitement prevailed. A general thrill shared not only by my friend's dog, but by several dogs belonging to the house and located in various parts of it, for one and all began to bark savagely. When the lights eventually disappeared and the dogs became silent, we relit the lamps. We then related our respective experiences. Some of us had heard ghostly footsteps moving about the premises, others had heard uncanny whistling, while there were those who had seen and heard nothing. I asked Miss H. if she had been conscious of the psychic current that had swept past me, and she said she had. She had felt something very unusual and unpleasant suddenly approach her. She was quite sure that it was not the spirit of the smoker. She had seen him in the room directly afterwards, but he was friendly. She thought that the phenomenon must be one of the numerous psychic entities that sometimes haunted the immediate vicinity of the house, but which rarely entered it. One of the other sitters told me afterwards that she was holding one of Miss H.'s hands at the time and could feel Miss H. trembling violently. After a short interval, we sat in the darkness again. This time I, too, heard the uncanny whistling. It was just as if someone was standing by the window whistling to an animal, and it was followed by the sound of faraway horse hooves. The sounds drew rapidly nearer and seemed to pass through the room, dying gradually away in the distance. Directly afterwards, I heard mutterings and whisperings, then silence. After a time, Miss H. relit the lamp and asked if anyone had heard the sounds of a horse in the room. I and several others told her that we had. She then informed us that she and Miss D. had often heard the sounds of a horse tearing through the room, always at the same hour, namely 2 o'clock in the morning, the very time I had heard the sounds. The sitting, which ended as dawn broke, had been successful in that it corroborated the statement of the two women, Miss H. and Miss D., that Black House was really haunted. I afterwards looked up the history and traditions relative to Whittlebury Forest and found that the locality was throughout long centuries borne the reputation of being haunted. One of the apparitions is that of a headless horseman, whose appearance is regarded as a portent of misfortune, even death. Happily, no one saw the horseman that night. It is said to be more often seen in the lanes and fields in the neighborhood of Black House. A phantom lady is also said to haunt the site of old Whittlebury Forest as a punishment for her cruel treatment of one of her lovers. She is nocturnally haunted by a phantom huntsman and a pack of spectral hounds. It is this particular haunting that is said to have suggested to Dryden his poem of Theodore and Honoria. A Night Vigil at Christchurch. Many people will remember the sensation caused in the neighborhood of Bournemouth by the murder of Mr. Rattenbury and the subsequent suicide of his clever and beautiful widow in a pool of the River Avon. It was the hearing of rumors of ghostly happenings supposedly arising from the widow's death, that led to my holding a vigil on a night in October 1935 at the scene of her unhappy ending. The morning of the day I selected for the vigil was very wet, but the weather improved later in the day. I arrived at Christchurch about noon, and at once made inquiries concerning the rumors. The evening was well advanced when I eventually set out on my errand, armed with nothing more formidable than a thick stick and a torch. The spot where Mrs. Rattenbury had destroyed herself the previous June was a kind of backwater of the Avon, in a lonely meadow about 300 yards from a lane, and close to some railway arches. One of the stories I heard was that a woman cycling along the lane one evening, a few weeks before, had heard a series of cries coming from the direction, so she thought of the arches. There was something so unearthly and altogether unusual about the cries that she got off her bicycle at once and stood by a wooden gate leading into a meadow, skirting the lane and facing the distant river. By the railway embankment and arches was a shed, and as the woman stood listening, she saw a blue light suddenly appear over the shed and then come towards her. As it drew nearer, it took the form of a very tall person, wearing a shroud. No face was visible, but there was something so awesome about the figure, especially in the long strides it took, that the woman became terrified and, jumping on her cycle, pedaled frantically away. Another story was said to have originated with a railway employee who, when walking along the embankment one night, saw something very bright on the river bank. He climbed down to get a closer look and, to his surprise, saw that it was a knife. On his approaching, the knife vanished, and he then noticed a commotion in the water. In one spot, the water was whirling round and round like a miniature whirlpool. Then suddenly it grew still, and out of it rose a hand. It was a very white hand with rather long, slender fingers, on one of which flashed and sparkled a ring. For some seconds the fingers clutched the air convulsively, and then the hand sank out of sight. The railway man, who had all this time stood rooted to the ground with shock, now took to his heels, convinced that it was no human being he had seen in the whirlpool. These were not altogether nice stories to remember when I was padding the lane alone, but they would keep coming back to me, and I remembered also a third, the story of a cyclist who, when riding along the lane one night, soon after the Rattenbury tragedy, had, on getting near the embankment, seen a woman, young and smartly dressed, walking alongside him. Although he increased his speed, it made no difference. She still kept abreast of him, apparently without increasing her pace, and this continued for some little distance, when suddenly she quite inexplicably vanished. 3 nights following, he had the same experience, and always in the particular part of the road. But on none of these occasions could he ever see the woman's face with any degree of clearness. It always seemed to be hidden by a mist, though the rest of her, her arms, legs, and body, stood out with startling distinctiveness. After the third night, he is said never to have seen her again. I thought of this story whenever a cyclist came along. As the night lengthened and the traffic grew less and less, till it practically ceased, a feeling of intense eeriness came over me. Later, as I came to a halt by a gate, which I imagine was the gate from which the woman had seen the shrouded figure, I was conscious of a feeling of intense sadness. It came upon me quite suddenly, a terrible sadness that seemed due not to anything hitherto associated with me in any way, but to the surroundings, to something connected with what I saw. The long, lone railway embankment, with 3 gaping arches, the solitary hut, the great stretch of unkempt grass flecked with stunted and oddly fashioned trees, and the dikes of water, whose surface gleamed in the starlight. I suddenly felt that something was coming along the lane. I say felt because I saw and heard nothing, yet I was certain as I have been about anything in my life, that something had entered into the darkness of the night and was drawing near me. Nearer and nearer it drew, a nameless presence, one that brought with it increasing sadness. It came right up to me. I was conscious of it standing by my side, looking at me, trying to read my innermost thoughts. I sensed beauty appertaining to it, beauty and youth, but not happiness or goodness. Yet I felt it was not wholly evil. It passed on and left me, and with its departure I was no longer sad. I left the gate and walked towards Rotten Row, but I had not gone far before I stopped. I felt I had to. I was near an isolated tree growing close to the lane side. A black mist rose out of the ground near a tree. I have never seen anything so unpleasantly black. I had not felt afraid when I had the experience near the gate, but I felt uneasy now. The mist crept slowly toward me, indescribably sinister. I felt impelled to go back to the gate. When I got there, a feeling came over me that I must drown myself. The river had suddenly become a magnet. No longer dark and cold, it seemed now to give out light. A light that was most alluring and seductive. The light drew me on, and I had to fight desperately to keep where I was and prevent myself from succumbing to its fatal influence, which I instinctively associated with the mist. Then suddenly all desire to drown myself ceased. Feeling that nothing further would occur, I now came away to learn later that others had experienced some of the strange things I experienced there, in particular the terrible desire to drown oneself in the spot where Mrs. Rattenberry ended her life. Is her spirit at rest? Some think not. I keep asking myself, was that sad presence hers? Did something draw her to the riverside as something tried to draw me? And was it that sinister black mist? You must form your own conclusions on these strange happenings, which are described exactly as they occurred. The house in Berkeley Square. Probably no case of haunting in England has ever attracted more attention than that which was alleged to take place at a house in Berkeley Square. Berkeley Square lies in the very heart of Mayfair, and consequently when it was rumored that a house in such a fashionable and highly aristocratic surroundings had a ghost, and a very terrible one too, all society at once became interested. Lord Lyttelton wrote in Notes and Queries for November 16, 1872, "It is quite true that there is a house in Berkeley Square, said to be haunted and long unoccupied on that account. There are strange stories about it, into which this deponent cannot enter." And 7 years later, Mayfair Magazine stated, "The house in Berkeley Square contains at least one room, of which the atmosphere is supernaturally fatal to body and mind. For years the house continued to stand empty because of the dreadful, uncanny thing said to occur there. Few people dared to pass it alone late at night." Among the stories told me about the haunting is the following. One bitterly cold night in December, two sailors named Stevens and Carey, who had come from Southampton to London on a week's furlough, having squandered all their money, found themselves penniless with nothing to eat and nowhere to sleep. After rambling along forlornly along street after street, seeking in vain an archway or alcove where they could find rest and shelter from the icy wind, they came at length to Berkeley Square, silent and deserted. They were leaning against the railings of the square garden when Stevens suddenly said, "Do you see that house over yonder, matey? It's to let. Why shouldn't we get in and do a night on the boards?" Carey at once agreed. He was desperately tired, and the prospect of being able to lie down in the quiet somewhere, even if it was only in a coal hole, appeared to him. Biding their opportunity when no one was about, the two seamen cautiously approached the house and slipped back the latch of one of the windows, which to their joy and surprise was not barred, and climbed into the house. Groping their way along a dank, dark passage, they bumped against banisters, and after a brief pause decided to venture aloft. On reaching the second floor, they decided to spend the night in one of the back rooms. It was a trifle more dismal and rather in worse condition than the other rooms they had seen, but on the outside wall near the window there was a pipe which could easily be got to should they be disturbed. Feeling that a fire would be comforting, they stole downstairs, careful lest their footsteps might be heard next door. Not finding any stray wood anywhere, they broke up two or three fixed drawers in the kitchen dresser, and returning to the room they had chosen for the night, they soon had a fire. The heat from it gradually made them drowsy, and presently they fell asleep. They were abruptly roused by sounds in the lower part of the house. As they sat up and listened, the sounds likened to footsteps and began to ascend the stairs. The footsteps might have been made with bare, fat feet. There was a curious shuffling stealthiness about them. They crossed the first floor landing and began to climb the stairs to the second floor. A great terror gripped the sailors. The steps at length came onto the landing, approached the room and halted at the door, the handle of which began slowly to turn. After a period of agonizing suspense, the two men saw the door slowly open and something of indescribable horror, neither human nor animal, appeared on the threshold. As it moved stealthily toward the men, the spell that had held them broke. Stevens made a dash to the window, but so great was his terror that in grabbing at the water pipe to climb down it, he missed and crashed to the ground. The injuries he received were so severe that he died, but not before he was able to explain what had happened. Carey was found by a policeman early in the morning, roaming round and round the square, quite insane. There is another story of the haunting of Berkeley Square. A family, whom I will call Jarvis, on coming to London one autumn, took up residence in the house. After they had been in it for some weeks, one of the maids, happening to go into the room in which the two sailors had suffered their harrowing experience, was shortly afterwards heard screaming for help. Fearing she was ill, Mrs. Jarvis ran to the room and found the girl lying on the floor in a fit. The maid never properly recovered, but from her rambling statements it was inferred that her lamentable condition was solely due to something very dreadful that she had seen in the room. After this, the room was kept locked, and no one ever ventured within its precincts, till a friend of the Jarvises, a Captain Raymond, who was engaged to one of the daughters, hearing what had happened, begged to be allowed to sleep there. He was so persistent that Mr. and Mrs. Jarvis finally gave in to him, on a condition, however, that some arrangement was made by which he could summon aid if he needed. To this Raymond agreed, and it was decided that in order to let the family know that all was going well with him, he should ring the bell by his bedside once every hour between midnight and dawn. If, on the contrary, something amiss should happen, and he should suddenly need help, he gave his most solemn assurance that he would ring the bell twice. The chosen night arrived, and as the captain retired to the room, the rest of the family, unknown to him, assembled together in the hall. No one dared to go to bed. Very slowly the minutes passed away until midnight drew near. Then from afar came the slow and measured chimes of the church clock. Simultaneous with a third stroke, a bell gave a single solitary tinkle, and everyone expressed themselves immeasurably relieved. Again there came a wait, and the minutes crept tediously by, with the family's nerves full stretched. Reassurance came from one of the Jarvis boys, who disclosed that the captain had in his possession a big service six-shooter. He had asked that no one be told about this in case he should be scared and fancy he might shoot someone with it. Then suddenly all heard the bell. This time a clang, as if it had been pulled violently. Then a slight pause, a very faint tinkle, and the loud crack of a revolver, after which silence. Amid frenzied cries from the women, a wild rush was made for the stairs, Mr. Jarvis leading the way, candle in one hand and poker in the other, to be joined en route by the servants, who came running down from their quarters on the top landing with white and terrified faces. On bursting into the room, the family found Captain Raymond shot dead by his own revolver. What terrible thing had forced his hand? The Werewolf and Other Things. The wolf is not the only animal whose shape, it is stated, man may possess the power of assuming, and it may be of some interest to inquire briefly into the varying branches of lycanthropy, comparing them with one already under discussion. In Orissa, the power of metamorphosing into a tiger is asserted by the Khans to be hereditary, and also to be acquired through the practice of magic. Many who have traveled in this country have assured me there is a very great amount of truth in this assertion, and that although there are, without doubt, a number of impostors among those designated were-tigers, there are most certainly many who are genuine. As with the wolf, so with the were-tiger, the metamorphosis is usually dependent on the hour of the day and generally occurs contemporaneous with the setting of the sun. But the lycanthropy of the were-tiger differs from that of the werewolf inasmuch as there is a definite god or spirit in the shape of a tiger that is directly responsible for the bestowal of the property. This tiger deity is looked upon and worshipped as a totem or national deity, that is to say, as a divine being that has the welfare of the Khan nation, especially at heart. It is communed with at homes, but more particularly in the wild dreariness of the jungle, where on the condition that the prayers of its devotees are sufficiently concentrated and in earnest, it confers as an honor and privilege the power of transmutation into its own shape. Some idea of this appearance may perhaps be gathered from the following description of it given me by Mr. K., whose name I see in the list of passengers reported missing in the deplorable disaster to the Titanic. Anxious to see, Mr. K. stated, if there was anything of truth in the alleged materialization of the tiger totem, to those supplicating it, I went one evening to a spot in the jungle, some 2 or 3 miles from the village where I had been informed the manifestations took place. As the jungle was universally held to be haunted, I met no one, and, in spite of my dread of the snakes, big cats, wild boars, scorpions, and other poisonous vermin with which the place was swarming, arrived without mishap at the place that had been so carefully described to me, a circular clearing of about 20 feet in diameter, surrounded on all sides by rank grass of a prodigious height, tulsi shrubs, kulpa, and tamarind trees. Quickly concealing myself, I waited the coming of the would-be tiger man. He was hardly more than a boy, slim and almost feminine, and came gallivanting along the narrow path through the brushwood like some careless, high-spirited, brown-skinned hoyden. The moment he reached the edge of the mystic circle, however, his behavior changed. The light of laughter died from his eyes. His lips straightened, his limbs stiffened, and his whole demeanor became one of respect and humility. Advancing with bare head and feet some 3 or so feet into the clearing, he knelt down and, touching the ground 3 times in succession with his forehead, looked up at a giant kulpa tree opposite him, chanting as he did so some weird and monotonous refrain, the meaning of which was unintelligible to me. Up to then it had been light, the sky like all Indian skies at that season, one blaze of moonbeams and stars, but now it gradually grew dark. An unnatural, awe-inspiring shade seemed to swoop down from the far distant mountains and to hush into breathless silence everything it touched. Not a bird sang, not an insect ticked, not a leaf stirred. One might have said all nature slept, had it not been for an uncomfortable sensation that the silence was but the silence of intense expectation, merely the prelude to some unpleasant revelation that was to follow. At this juncture, my feelings were certainly novel, entirely different from any I had hitherto experienced. I had not believed in the supernatural, and had had absolutely no apprehensions of coming across anything of a ghostly character. All my fears had been of malicious natives and tigers. They now, however, changed, and I was confronted with a dread of what I could not understand and could not analyze, of something that suggested an appearance alarming on account of its very vagueness. The pulsations of my heart became irregular. I grew faint and sick and painfully susceptible to a sensation of excessive coldness, which instinct told me was quite independent of any actual change in the atmosphere. I made several attempts to remove my gaze from the kulpa tree, which intuition told me would be the spot where the something, whatever it was, that was going to happen, would manifest itself. My eyes, however, refused to obey, and I was obliged to keep them steadily fixed on this spot, which grew more and more gloomy. All of a sudden, the silence was broken, and a cry, half human and half animal, but horribly ominous, sounding at first faint and distant, speedily grew louder and louder. Soon I heard footsteps, the footsteps of something running towards us, and covering the ground with huge, light strides. Nearer and nearer it came, till with a sudden spring it burst into view. The giant reeds and trulsis were dashed aside, and I saw standing in front of the kulpa tree a vertical column of crimson light of perhaps 7 feet in height and 1 or so in width. A column. Only a column, though the suggestion conveyed to me by the column was nasty. Nasty with a nastiness that baffles description. I looked at the native, and the expression in his eyes and mouth assured me he saw more. a very great deal more. For some seconds, he only gasped, then by degrees the rolling of his eyes and twitching of his lips ceased. He stretched out a hand and made some sign on the ground. Then he produced a string of beads, and after placing it over the scratchings he had made on the soil, jerked out some strange incantation in a voice that thickened and quivered with terror. I then saw a stream of red light steal from the base of the column and dart like forked lightning to the beads, which instantly shone a luminous red. The native now picked them up, and putting them round his neck, clapped the palms of his hands vigorously together, uttering as he did so a succession of shrill cries that gradually became more and more animal in tone, and finally ended in a roar that converted every particle of blood in my veins into ice. The crimson color now abruptly vanished. Whither it went, I know not. The shade that had been veiling the jungle was dissipated, and in the burst of brilliant moonlight that succeeded, I saw peering up at me, from the spot where the native had lain, the yellow glittering, malevolent eyes, not of a man, but a tiger thirsting for human blood. The shock was so great that for a moment or two I was paralyzed and could only stare back at the thing in fascinated helplessness. Then a big bird close at hand screeched, and some small quadruped flew past me, terrified. And with these awakenings of nature, all my faculties revived, and I simply jumped on my feet and fled. Some 50 yards ahead of me, and showing their tops well above the moon-kissed reeds and bushes, were two trees, a tamarind and a copa brixia. God knows why I decided on the latter. Probably through a mere fluke, for I hadn't the remotest idea which of the trees offered the best facilities to a poor climber. My mind once made up, there was no time to alter. The were-tiger was already terribly close behind. I could gauge its distance by the patter of its feet. Apparently, the metamorphosis had only been in part, and by the steadily intensifying purr-purr, so unmistakably interpretive of the brute's utter satisfaction in its power to overtake me, as well as at the prospect of so good a meal. I was just 13 stone, seemingly a most unlucky number even in weight. Had the tiger wanted, I am sure he could have caught me at once, but I fancy it wished to play with me a little first, to let me think I was going to escape, and then, when it had got all the amusement possible out of me, just to give a little sprint and haul me over. Perhaps it was my anger at such undignified treatment of the human race that gave a kind of sting to my running, for I certainly got over the ground at twice the speed I had ever done before, or ever thought myself capable of doing. At times my limbs were on the verge of mutiny, but I forced them onward, and though my lungs seemed bursting, I never paused. At last a clearing was reached, and the copa tree stood fully revealed. I glanced at once at the trunk. The lowest branch of any size was some 8 feet from the ground. Could I reach it? Summoning up all my efforts for this final and in all probability fatal rush, I hurled myself forward. There was a low exultant roar, a soft, almost feminine purr, and a long hairy paw with black gleaming claws shot past my cheek. I gave a great gasp of anguish, and with all the pent-up force of despair clutched at the branch overhead. My fingertips just curled over it. I tightened them, but at the most it was a very feeble, puny grasp, and totally insufficient to enable me to swing my body out of reach of the tiger. I immediately gave myself up as lost, and was endeavoring to reconcile myself to the idea of being slowly chewed alive, when an extraordinary thing happened. The were-tiger gave a low growl of terror, and bounding away was speedily lost in the jungle. Fearing it might return, I waited for some time in the tree, and then, as there was no sign of it, descended, and very cautiously made my way back to the village. That night, an entire family, father, mother, son, and daughter, were murdered, and their mutilated and half-eaten bodies were discovered on the floor of their hut in the morning. Evidence pointed to their having been killed by a tiger, and as they had been the sworn enemies of the young man whose metamorphosis I had witnessed, it was not difficult to guess at the identity of their destroyer. I related my adventure to one of the chief people, and he informed me he knew that particular copa tree well. "You undoubtedly owe your salvation to having touched it," he said. The original kopa, which now stands in the first heaven, is said to have been one of the 14 remarkable things churned up by the churning of the ocean by the gods and demons, and the name of Ram and his consort Seter are written on the silvery trunks of all its earthly descendants. If once you touch any portion of a kopa briksha tree, you are quite safe from any animal. That is why the were-tiger snarled and ran away. But take my advice, Sahib, and leave the village. I did so, and on the way to my home in the hills, visited the tree. There, sure enough, plainly visible on the silvery surface in the twilight, was the name of the incarnation of Vishnu, written in Sanskrit characters. I did not want any further proofs. I had had enough. And taking good care to see my gun was loaded, I hurried off, nor have I ever ventured into that neighborhood since. Mr. K, continuing, informed me that, from what he had been told by his friend in the Khand village, he concluded that only those who had been initiated into the full rites of magic in their early youth could see the totem in its full state of materialization, i.e., an enormous tiger, half man and half beast. To those who were in some degree clairvoyant, it would appear that it had appeared to him a mere column of crimson light, crimson on account of its association with black magic, while as to those who were not in any way clairvoyant, it would remain entirely invisible. The young Khand had prayed for the property of lycanthropy solely as a means of revenge on those whom he had imagined had wronged him, and as a were-tiger he was able to destroy them in the most cruel manner possible. The property, when once acquired, however, could never be cast off, and the young man would willy-nilly undergo transmutation every night, and in all probability continue killing and eating people till someone plucked up the courage, for were-tigers were not only dreaded, but held in the greatest awe, to shoot him. There are certain tribes in India known to be adepts in occultism, and therefore one is not surprised to find lycanthropy linked with the mysterious jugglery, etherical projection, and other psychic feats accomplished by these tribesmen. The were-tiger is not confined to the Khands. It is met with in Malaysia, in the gorgeous tropical forests of Java and Sumatra, where it is feared more than anything on earth by the gentle and intelligent natives. And if rumor be true, in the great lone mountains and dense jungles, and along the hot, unhealthy river banks of New Guinea. In Arawak, it gives place to the word jaguar. In Ashangoland, and many parts of West Africa, to the were-leopard. Some years ago, there was a current among certain tribes of the natives in Arawak a story to this effect. A Dutch trader of the name of Van Heelen was visiting for purely business purposes an Indian settlement in a very remote part of the colony. Roaming about the village one evening, he came to a hut standing alone on the outskirts of one of those dense forests that are so characteristic of Arawak. Van Heelen paused and was marveling how anyone could choose to live in so outlandish and lonely a spot, when a shrill scream followed by a series of violent guttural ejaculations came from the interior of the building, and the next moment a little boy, some 7 or 8 years of age, rushed out of the house pursued by a prodigiously fat woman who whacked him soundly across the shoulders with a knotted club and then halted for want of breath. Van Heelen, who was well versed in the native language, politely asked her what the boy had done to deserve so severe a chastisement. "Done," the woman replied, opening her beady little eyes to their full extent. "Why, he's not done anything. That's why I beat him. He's incorrigibly idle. He and his sister spend all their time amid the trees yonder conversing with the bad spirits. They learned that trick from Guska with the evil eye. She has bewitched them. She was shot to death with arrows in the marketplace last year, and my only regret is that she wasn't put out of the way 10 years sooner. Ah, there's that wicked girl. Jarakna, she's been hiding from me all the day. I must punish her, too." And before Van Heelen could speak, the indignant parent waddled off with surprising swiftness for one of her vast proportions, and reappeared dragging by the wrist an elfish-looking girl of about 10. She gave the urchin one blow and was about to give her another when Van Heelen, whose heart was particularly tender where children were concerned, interfered and by dint of bribery persuaded her to desist. She retired indoors and Van Heelen found himself alone with the child. "May the spirit of the woods forever be your friend," the maiden said. But for you, my poor back would have been beaten to a tonka bean. My brother and I have suffered enough at the hands of the old woman. We'll suffer no more." "What will you do then?" Van Heelen asked, shocked at the revengeful expression that marred the otherwise pretty features of the child. "Remember, she's your mother and has every right to expect you to be obedient and industrious." "She is not our mother," the girl answered. "Our mother is the spirit of the woods. We work for her, not for this old woman, and in return she tells us tales and amuses us." "You work for her?" Van Heelen said in amazement. "What do you mean?" The child smiled. The ignorance of the white man tickled her. "We gather aloes for medicine for her sick children, the core of the lechugila for their food, yucca leaves for plumes for their heads, and scarlet panicles of the splendens for their clothes. My brother and I will go to her tonight when the old woman is sleeping. Where? We do not tell anyone that. Do we see her? The spirit of the woods, you mean? Yes, we see her. But it's not everyone who can see her, only those who have sight like ours. But I must go now. My brother is calling me." Van Heelen could hear nothing, though he did not doubt from the child's behavior that she had been called. She ran merrily away, and he watched her black head disappear in the thick undergrowth facing him. Van Heelen's curiosity was roused. What the child had said impressed him deeply, and against his saner judgment he resolved to secrete himself near the hut and watch. After it had been dusk some time and all sounds had ceased, he saw the two children emerge from the hut and, tiptoeing softly toward the trees, fall on their hands and knees and crawl along a tiny deviating path. Hardly knowing what he was doing, but impelled by a force he could not resist, Van Heelen followed them. It was a delicious night. At that time of year, every night in Arawak is delicious, and Van Heelen, who was very simple in his love of nature, imbibed the light through every pore in his body. As he trod gently along, pushing first this branch and then that out of the way, and stooping down to half his height to creep under a formidable bramble, countless voices from animal land fell on his ears. From a glimmering patch of water away on his left came the trump of a bullfrog and the wail of the whippoorwill. A monkey chattered, a parrot screeched, while a shrill cry of terror, accompanied by a savage growl, plainly told of the surprise and slaughter of some defenseless animal by one of the big beasts of prey that made every tree their lurking place. On any other occasion, Van Heelen would have thought twice before embarking on such an expedition, but that night he seemed to be laboring under some charm which had lulled to sleep all sense of insecurity. It was true he was armed, but of what avail is a rifle against the unexpected spring of a jaguar or leopard from a bow some 10 or 20 feet directly above one's head, or the sudden lunge of a boa constrictor? At first the path wound its way through a dense chaparral consisting of the various shrubs and plants rarely to be met with in other parts of Arawak, namely acacias, aloes, lechuguillas, and the splendens. But after a short time, this kind of vegetation was succeeded by something far more imposing, by dense masses of trees, many of them at least 150 feet in height. The mora, which from a distance appears like a hillock, clothed with the brightest vegetation. The eucorari, or red cedar, and the guamara, laden with tonka beans. So thick was their foliage overhead that one by one Van Heelen watched the stars disappear, and the path ahead of him darkened till it was as much as he could go to grope along. Still, he was not afraid. The thought of that elfish little maiden with the luminous eyes crawling along in front of him inspired him with extraordinary confidence, and he plunged on, anxious only to catch another glimpse of her and see the play out. Once his progress was interrupted by something hot and leathery that pushed him nearly off his feet and puffed rudely in his face. It was on the tip of his tongue to give vent to his ruffled feelings in a forcible language, but the knowledge that this would assuredly warn the children of his proximity kept him quiet, and he contented himself with striking a vigorous blow. There was a loud snort, a crashing and breaking of brushwood, and the thing, whatever it was, rushed away. Another time he stumbled over a snake which was gliding from one side of the path to the other. The creature hissed, and Van Heelen, giving himself up for lost, jumped for all he was worth. As luck would have it, the snake missed, and Van Heelen escaped with nothing more serious than a few scratches and a bump or two, was able to continue his course. After long gropings, the path at length came to an end, the tree cleared, and Van Heelen saw before him a pool radiantly illuminated by the moon, and in the very center an immense Victoria Regia water lily. Though accustomed to the fine species of this plant in Guyana, which is the home of the Victoria Regia, Van Heelen was doubtful if he had ever before held such a magnificent specimen. The silvery moonlight falling in its white and pink petals threw into relief all the exquisite delicacy of their composition, and gave to them a glow which could only have been rivaled in Elysium. Indeed, the whole scene, enhanced by the glamour of the hour and the sweet scent of plants and flowers, was so reminiscent of fairyland that Van Heelen, enraptured beyond description, stood and gazed in open-mouthed ecstasy. Then his eyes fell on the children, and he noiselessly slipped back under cover of a tree. Hand in hand, the boy and girl advanced to the water's edge, and kneeling, commenced to recite some strange incantation, which Van Heelen tried in vain to interpret. Sometimes their voices reached a high plaintive key, sometimes they sank to a low murmur, strangely musical and strangely suggestive of the babbling of brook water over stones and pebbles. When they had finished their incantation, they got up and, running to some bushes, returned in a few seconds with their arms full of flowers, which they threw with great dexterity onto the leaves of the giant lily. With their faces still turned to the water, they remained standing side by side, whilst a silence deep and impressive and shared, so it appeared to Van Heelen by all nature, fell upon them. A cold current of air rising apparently from the pool blew across the opening and, sweeping past Van Heelen, set all the leaves in motion. It rustled on till its echoes gradually ceased and all was still again. It now seemed to Van Heelen that the character of everything around underwent a subtle change, and the feeling that every object around him was indulging in a hearty laugh at his expense intensified with every breath he drew. For the first time, Van Heelen was afraid. He could not define the cause of his fear, but that only made his fear the more acute. He was frightened of the wind and darkness, and of something concealed in it, something cloaked by the wind and darkness. Even the atmosphere had altered. It too was making game of him. It distorted his vision. The things he saw round him were no longer stationary. They moved. They twirled and twisted themselves into all sorts of grotesque and fanciful attitudes, grew large, then small, nearer and then more distant. The plot of ground in front of which the children knelt played all manner of pranks. Pranks Van Heelen did not at all like. It moved round and round, faster and faster, until it eventually became a whirlpool, which suddenly reversed and assumed the appearance of a pyramid revolving on its apex. Quicker and quicker it spun round, closer and closer it drew, until without warning it suddenly stopped and disappeared, while its place was taken by an oddly shaped bulge in the ground, which, swaying backward and forward, increased and increased in stature, till it attained the height of some 7 or 8 feet. Van Heelen could not compare this with anything he had ever seen. It was monstrous but shapeless, a mere mass of irregular lumps, a dull reddish white, and vibrating horribly in the moonlight. He thought of the children, but where they had stood, he saw only two greenish-yellow spheres that, twirling round and round, suddenly approached him. As he started back to escape them, all was again changed. The lumpy figure had vanished, the atmosphere cleared, and everything was absolutely normal. There was now, however, solid grounds for fear. Advancing on him with flashing eyes and scintillating teeth were two vividly marked jaguars, a male and a female. Van Heelen, usually calm and collected in the face of danger, on this occasion lost his presence of mind. His gun dropped from his hands, his knees quivered, and helpless and inert, he reeled against the tree under which he had been standing. The jaguars, which seemed to be unusually savage, even for jaguars, prepared to spring, and Van Heelen, certain his hour had come, was about to close his eyes and resign himself to his fate when the female brute, although the bigger, more formidable, hesitated, thrust its dark, handsomely spotted head almost in its victim's face, and then, lashing its companion sharply with its tail, swerved aside and was off like a dart. It took Van Heelen some minutes to realize his escape, and then, More in a dream than awake, he mechanically shouldered his rifle and slowly followed in the beast's wake. An hour's walking brought him to the end of the forest. The dawn was breaking, and the track leading to the settlement was just beginning to exhibit the mellowing influence of the first rays of the sun. There was an exhilarating freshness in the air that made Van Heelen keenly sensitive to the ambitious demands of a newly awakened stomach. Opposite him was the hut of the old woman, the entrance somewhat clumsily blocked with a makeshift door. As Van Heelen looked at it curiously, wondering if the woman was on the habit of barricading it in this fashion on account of her proximity to the forest, sounds greeted him from within. Stepping lightly up to the hut, Van Heelen listened attentively. Some big animal, a hound most probably, was gnawing a bone. Crunch, crunch, crunch. Van Heelen moved away, but hadn't gone very far before an indefinable something made him turn back. That crunching, was it a dog or was it? His heart turned sick within him at the bare thought. Again he listened at the threshold, and again he heard the sounds. Gnaw, gnaw, crunch, crunch, crunch. He rapped at first gently and then loudly, ever so loudly. The gnawing at once stopped, but no one answered him. Then he called once, twice, thrice. There was no reply. Assured now there was something amiss, he gripped his rifle and, putting his shoulder to the door, burst it open. A flood of daylight rushed in, and he saw before him on the floor the mutilated and half-eaten remains of a woman, and, did his eyes deceive him, or did he see, crouching in a corner, all ready to spring, two magnificent jaguars. Van Heelen raised his rifle, but, in less than a second, it fell from his grasp. Towards him, from the very same spot, their small mouth and slender hands smeared with blood, ran Yerakna and her brother.